This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's the 52nd day of a gang truce in Chicago. It's a hopeful sign for my guest, Al Carter. For 22 years, Carter has run a youth foundation in Chicago's Cabrini Green Housing Project. The project is infamous for its gang shootouts. Carter runs an athletic program there and spends a lot of time in the streets trying to talk kids into going back to school and staying out of trouble. He also works as Chicago's youth service coordinator. Cabrini Green is where Carter came of age. His family moved there when he was 12 and moved out when he was 19. The project is like a small city. It includes 57 high-rises and 42 row houses. 91% of its 6,000 residents are unemployed. The Chicago gang truce was called just a few days after a 7-year-old boy named Dantrell Davis was shot by a sniper in Cabrini Green. The mayor and the head of the Chicago Housing Authority responded to the murder by ordering a security sweep of the housing project. The Davis murder was traumatic for the residents of Cabrini Green, but it wasn't the first of its kind.
There was 1985. There was a little girl shot, jumping rope, 9-year-old girl. Then in the, 2 months later, that was in June of 1985. Then 2 months later, there was a little boy opening, who was 12 years old, opening a door and got his head blown off with a shotgun. Then I think the following year, a young man coming from school, high school, was ROTC student, A student, got shot in the back, fell at my feet, died. Then there was his brother of the same family coming home from a McDonald's. He was 15 years old. He got shot, robbed. Then there was a kid who was on a boxing program that we supervised at the Chicago Park District who was shot from a high-rise building. He died. He was 9 years old. Then there was a girl who was 12 years old who was in the middle of a gang fight and got hit by a stray bullet, and she died. So there have been a number of incidents that have occurred over the last, since 1985 that I can recall, because I spoke at 5 of those funerals.
What could you tell us about how Dantrell Davis got shot?
Well, he was shot from a high-rise, from the police report, and as he walked from his home, which is about 100 feet to the school, and he was shot. That's as much as I know. In fact, I can only say that I knew the victim and I knew the offender.
You knew both of them?
Yeah. The offender, a 33-year-old person who played in my softball programs over about 20 years ago.
Wow.
It's one of those things. And so happened, Dantrell, I knew him through the elementary school dinner that we run programs in.
Does that happen a lot where people who you've worked with when they're young end up in gangs and end up becoming criminals, and you kind of watch them, try to keep them out of it, but don't always succeed?
Well, that's a part of trying to what do we call duck the bullet? Your whole goal in life is to try to duck the bullet, not necessarily mean the bullet is going to hit you, but duck in the way of life that has traumatized a community like Cabrini Green with the drugs, the child abuse, the misuse of the misappropriation of funds from agencies. The whole problem that stems around poverty is a way of life, and we're hoping and struggling that these young people can go under that. Don't get hit by that bullet. Of the over thousands of young people that we work with over the past 20 years, I can say that there have been about 10, 15 successes, that have gone on and graduated from Morehouse Clark College down in Atlanta. You're going up to Wisconsin, Madison, and graduated, that have gone on to be successful. Those are the young people that have ducked the bullet. But it's difficult when you got bullets flying all over. You got your peers, you got the parents, you got the school, you got quite a bit of pressure that's on you.
What do you tell the kids who you work with who might be really terrified after a shooting, especially if they were friends with the person who got shot? What did you tell kids after the Dantrell Davis shooting?
That the entire community is not that way. Everyone doesn't shoot a gun. Life must go on. It's unfortunate that he passed away. That's all you can tell. I mean, you probably have seen in papers and periodicals a lot of drawing of kids shooting a gun. But, we just try to bring to them another way. In fact, after the Dantrell Davis, we had a person who lived in Cabrini for years, who's now a captain of a nuclear submarine. He came in. He spoke to students at the Jenner School. We all tried to bring them something positive, opposed to bringing back the memory of a shooting of a young person. So we try to bring them something positive again, letting them know that this is not the way.
Is there advice, is there advice that you give kids about how to stay away from gunfire, or do you think that some of these acts are just so random that it's really not
when they were
something
occurring,
you can necessarily protect yourself against.
When it was occurring, it was just random shooting. People will just shoot a gun, you know, just shoot out of a window. In fact, the little boy, Anthony, 9-year-old, who was on the boxing program, he was shot on his way to Asua Park by two young people who were just firing a weapon out of a window. And the young people were told that they shot someone. And they didn't know that they had shot anybody. They were just shooting out of a window, firing a weapon. So, you know, it can happen anywhere, anytime, at that particular time. But again, it has ceased. And so, you know, that's what we're building on now. We're building on the positive opposed to the negative.
There's a truce in effect now?
Yes, it is.
How did the truce get called, do you know?
Well, several people from various factions came together and just said that it was about time that they, what you might say, come to their senses and stop murdering each other, because that's all it was. It was just blacks murdering blacks, or African-American men murdering African-American men, and African-American boys murdering African-American boys. And then that statistic that has been brought up about the extinct black man in the year 2000, which is an incredible belief, but, you know, it was about to happen if we'd have continued down that path. And I think it was about time that people began to come to their senses of murdering each other.
I guess I wonder how much you think the truce had to do with gangs sitting down and talking about the African-American male, and how much it had to do with maybe the heat is on, they need to kind of cool it for a while.
Well, I think people are not really putting together the fact that, you know, that the African-American male is a very intelligent person, and that they can begin to think for themselves and make young people aware of the fact that there's a possibility that we can become extinct. And especially, you know, we're shooting each other. I mean, we're just doing away with each other's life. We're snuffing each other out just with the pull of a trigger and then with the drop of a drug. So with this truce came about some harmony in the black community, which is now beginning to raise the esteem and raise the awareness of all these little African-American boys and girls.
Is this the longest truce that you can remember?
You know, really, I can't even recall a truce period. This is like all news, because for example, there's always been problems, you know, but this is good. I think, again, we're looking at, you know, something that might be even global. You know, it might take an effect on South Africa, where Boota Lazy and Mandela could come together.
What do you know about how the truce was negotiated?
Well, I know several of people that were involved in a truce, and they were able to bring people to sit down at the table and just come up with a common agenda, saving black lives. And they do have a table of elders where they sit, you know, if any kind of violation is committed in terms of a shooting or the truce is thought about being broken, those people have to go to the board of elders. These are some older men who then will be like a judge and jury and find this person guilty or not guilty of the crime that he's committed. And whatever happens after that, I don't have the faintest idea.
How has your day-to-day work changed during the truce?
Oh, it's been a lot better. We've got now more young people are able to come down to the site, come down to our foundation, want to get socially involved in a lot of activities now, in as much as that there has been a piece where a person now can walk across a field without getting shot at, or walk around a corner without being intimidated or being violated in terms of being beaten up. So it has created a very positive effect.
Have you been talking to any of the gang members during the truce about what they're doing now?
We talk to them all the time. In fact, they are really socially, and they're really getting involved in the housing developments now. They're attempting to become a part of the system, whereas that they are building council presidents in the various high-rise buildings and try to erase the negatives that have been brought upon them behind them being socially involved in gangs. They are now beginning to get younger people involved in the cleaning up of the community and to watching over the community and eliminating and moving away from that violence.
I know after the murder of Dantrell Davis, the Chicago police organized sweeps of the projects. Was that effective in creating a more secure feeling there? How do residents at Cabrini-Green feel about police sweeps? How do you feel about it personally?
Well, I think it has changed. I think it has to grow on people, but I think it has now been more more secure. But I have not heard from, you know, you hear maybe small dribblings of people complaining about the security, the lockdown, as they call it. But yet, you know, there are more people that live in CHA, and especially Cabrini, who can appreciate that security more so than they are those that do not.
Has there been a concerted police effort to get the guns away from the youth in Cabrini Green?
Oh, sure. With that lockdown, they went to every apartment. They went to every apartment in the CHA, as I know, in Cabrini. And as I am familiar with the sweeps, they go to every apartment with police. They knock on every door. For those that do not answer the door, especially in the vacant apartments, they go in and they search down the apartments. And they find weapons, they find contraband, you know, but they go to every apartment. They made serious attempts to try to find the weapons.
How effective do you think it was?
Well, I haven't heard any shootings. I haven't heard anyone even tell me of any shootings. We've had a few fist fights, but that's going to happen because now the guys are saying, hey, listen, we got to live together. So, you know, we might as well go ahead and get it out of our system. It's going to punch each other out and go with it after that. And I prefer that than them grabbing bats and guns.
Future joining us, my guest is Al Carter, and he runs a youth foundation at the Chicago Cabrini Green Housing Projects, and he's been running this since 1977. He's also the Youth Service Coordinator for the City of Chicago. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Al Carter, who runs a youth foundation at the Chicago Housing Project, Cabrini Green. When you organize teams or sporting events or whatever, what do you do to keep that event safe?
Well, and keeping it safe, you know, it's like you're saying, wherever there's organized activities, something's going to take place. That's never taken place. You know, we've not had any shooting out at on our field, you know. So, again, it's me being there all these years. I've watched young people grow up, and it's like, yeah, okay, Al Carter, you don't do those things around his programs, you know, because his programs are trying to raise the hopes of young people that are involved in his activity. You know, there have been some incidents where there might be a fist fight, but, you know, there's no such thing as a serious violence, because when there's a fist fight, we jump right on top of it, and both of those young people are put out of the program. Then they'll come back and say, please, can I come back? And we're talking about close to 500 young people that are socially involved in this African-American youth league. And again, that age is from 9 to 15. We play on a field that was once ground of Cooley High School, which this movie was written after. And this is what we call a NutriTurf. We had young people who were socially involved with gangs who would come up and do our umpire, who would do, you know, the umpire, and who would actually watch and supervise the activities of young people, because we found young people have a lot more respect for those guys who are socially involved in the gangs than they would for the guy who would be wearing a suit and tie to come out of work down the town at the First National Bank, and especially if he was black, because they would think he would not know what the real deal was out there on the street.
Are there kind of rules in the projects that an outsider wouldn't know? Do you know what I mean? Are there things that people inside know not to do that outsiders wouldn't know about?
You know, I'm just laughing at the way you're saying that. You know, and be very honest, white people could come into the housing developments, nothing ever happened. You know, however, there was a shooting of two white policemen back in 1970. But, you know, there are white people come in the community all the time. They're more accepted than blacks. And, you know, there's not a problem to happen. You know, you would think that, you know, if a white person go over there, she'll get raped and he'll get his throat cut. But we've got several churches that come over there quite a bit, you know, and take young people on out of the community, take them in for tutorial services, or take them over to the various churches, walk them over to Michigan Avenue, so let them go through the water tower. This is this 20-story building that's, you know, sells all types of expensive merchandise. Take them to hamburgers, McDonald's, Burger King, you know, Submarine. So, you know, these white folks walk into the community, pick the black children up, and take them on out. So there's no set of rules. That it's just like a community. It's just like a community up in Highland Park. It just so happened to be, as you call them, the projects, Chicago Housing Authority. But it's just another community. But that houses a lot of majority black people.
I guess maybe I've been reading too much. But I was reading one article, for instance, that said that one parent almost got into trouble because they didn't realize that the slant of a baby's cap could indicate that the father's a gang member of a specific gang, and that it was kind of giving off a signal that they didn't know they were giving off.
Well, you know, was this an African? Now, I need to ask you a question. Was this an African-American family?
I think so. I'm not sure if it was specified.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, normally that don't occur. That's a way out occurrence that would happen in a black community. You know, again, gangs in the black community is a means of survival. See, that's what all black folks got in common, is survival. And, you know, gangs in other communities is a means of novelty. You know, but in Chicago, gangs, and especially close to Cabrini Green, it's a means of survival. When a young guy can go out and shake down a parking meter and come up with some quarters, you know, he's taking it home because he needs to take it home because his ma is probably laid out with drugs and probably 6 months pregnant and ain't got no old man there, you know, so he's bringing it there to help feed his sister and brother, you know, so it's a means of survival, it's a means of a novelty, you know, there's a novelty in gangs also, you know, with this, the writings on the wall, there's a lot of the graffiti, you know, walking around with your chest stuck out, crossing your arms and throwing up forks by your fingers. That's a means of novelty, wearing your cap to the right and left. Black folks have always worn their caps to the right or the left. It was thought real hip and cool to wear your caps and hats like that back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Even up into the 60s, now we got it in the 90s. But yet, you know, people relate that as being a gang phenomenon, but it's not.
Since you see gangs as being a means of survival, do you try to talk kids out of joining gangs, or do you just try to talk them out of being violent if they're in gangs?
Talk them out of being violent, because one of the problems that exists among the paranoia and the stigma that has existed among black people for God knows how long is the fact that we're not sticking together. I look at gangs as a family means of being together, being able to communicate and work together. But I have the problem. I have the problem with the violence and the drugs within the gang. That's the problem I have. So therefore, yes, I do try to talk them out of being a part of anything that's negative that's in the gang.
Do you have any kids of your own?
Yes, I have two girls. In fact, I've got a 26-year-old daughter and a 11-year-old.
So one's an adult and one's still coming of age.
Exactly.
Have you been concerned as a parent about your kids getting into trouble, or have you been confident that they'd be okay?
Well, you know, it's just the struggles of the street, and again, them ducking the bullet. And the 26-year-old has ducked the bullet, but the 11-year-old is what I have to deal with now. You know, in terms of some young guy coming along telling her something in her ear, and she's gone off, and she's pregnant at 12 or 13. Or she's not even concerned about what's happening in school, and she sits up and bites her fingernails all day, and the next thing you know, she's graduating from elementary school, and she's dropping out of school out of high school at 14. So, yeah, I have serious concerns about my child.
What's the closest you've come to witnessing violence? You said before that one of...
Yeah, well, a young man was a ROTC student at a high school in Chicago here. He was shot in the back, and he ran and fell at my feet.
When was this? How did it happen?
He was shot from a high-rise. And, you know, I had a volleyball tournament playing around in front of the high-rise building. And we heard the fire, but we said, hey, well, that's on the other side, you know, other side of the building. So, you know, everyone where we were rather cool. So we saw the young person running, and he ran. He fell right there, grabbed my leg, and fell to the ground. And his father came out because someone ran, said his son had got shot, and his father came running over, and he just died right there.
What did you do?
What can I do? You know, what can I do? Just look. Spoke at the funeral.
You've spoken at several funerals for young people who've been...
Five, in fact.
What kinds of things do you say?
Hey, it's difficult. You know, it's difficult. You know, people are here for one reason, you know, to bring about their sympathy toward the death of a child, you know, and this is where we have to gather is the fact that the person is dead. Everybody comes together in harmony, you know. That was, again, prior to the troops, you know, everyone has to come down in harmony because of a death. You know, we were hoping that that kind of activity would go on prior to a death. You know, but again, all that's behind us now. We're looking forward to, you know, some real positive things now. In as much as the truth has gone on, we're looking for, you know, to try to take advantage of the calm.
I want to get back and ask you something that you'd referred to earlier. You said that one of the shootings took place by a couple of guys who were firing out the window. They didn't even know they'd hit somebody.
Mm-hmm.
What happened when these guys who were firing out the window found out that they actually hit somebody?
They were frightened to death because they were young people. So they were picked up. They were arrested. They were really nervous because they were told that they had shot someone. And the building that they had shot out of was a building that the kid lived in. So they saw that they had shot one of their friends.
Were they convicted?
Yes, I think they're serving some time.
What's the attitude that you've picked up on about going to jail? Does it frighten teenagers that you know?
It has, because, you know, the reality doesn't set in until you actually spend that first night in that joint. And then that's when the reality really sets in. You know, everyone is all cool and laid back, you know, until they go to the judge and the judge put the mallet on that board and tell you got 30 years. Then the whole it changes altogether. They feel real tough when they go in and the judge say, not enough evidence, case dismissed. He walk out and he run back to the neighborhood and say how he got over on the judge. But when he comes back again for the second time and the judge put the mallet down and tell him 20 years, the whole attitude just changes.
Now, we're recording this in the morning. What are your plans for the rest of the day? I know you have your city job, but, I mean, in terms of your work with the Cabrini-Green Youth Foundation, will you be doing that kind of work today?
Yeah, late this evening, you know, we're giving out candy boxes and things like that and having grab bags and trying to find a guy who wants to play the Santa Claus and during the Kwanzaa time. That's the problem. No one wants to put on a red uniform in Santa Claus.
So where will you be doing that?
We'll be doing it in a youth foundation. You know, we'll be giving away food baskets too. You know, turkeys with beans and rice and things like that.
Okay. I wish you happy holidays.
Thank you very much.
Al Carter runs a youth foundation at the Cabrini-Green Housing Project in Chicago. He's also Chicago's youth service coordinator. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.